case. It is 19-14777, Kiko Moss versus American Private Equity. And Mr. Robinson? And I understand that you're going to take 11 minutes, and Mr. Onias is going to take 2 minutes. And then, Mr. Robinson, you've saved the additional two for rebuttal, right?
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay, whenever you're ready.
May it please the court. My name is Dwayne Robinson. I'm representing appellant Freddie Rushen. This court should reverse the trial court below because the trial court allowed the entry of a judgment for fraud and punitive damages based on conduct that amounted nothing more than a breach of contract. For a separate and independent reason, this court should reverse because the fraud claim in this case was barred by the multiple releases signed by the parties. I want to briefly talk about the releases. The parties executed no less than 5 separate releases in this case. The releases addressed tort claims, it addressed contract claims, it addressed current claims and future claims, and it also addressed unknown claims and known claims. That release agreement also included at least 7 recitals, all of which related in some way to the Chemotech Commission that was the basis for the fraud claim below.
Can I ask you a procedural question before you get to the merits? Because I do think that there's a substantial argument about what the language of the releases covers, but I think you've got a procedural problem to deal with on that score. Release is an affirmative defense, and I don't mean you personally, but there was an attempt to amend the answer to add the affirmative defense of release a couple of months after the scheduling order was issued, right?
About a month and a couple weeks.
Okay. A month. Well, we'll use a month. A month after the scheduling order was issued. And the district judge denied that motion without prejudice because, in the district judge's view, there hadn't been a showing of good cause, right? And then there's no attempt to try to show good cause or to seek to amend again. And so it seems to me the only way that you could possibly prevail on, and maybe I'm wrong, on the release issue here on appeal is to show that the matter was necessarily tried by consent. Even if that's the case, the jury was not instructed on the releases. So how can we reverse on an issue that the jury never addressed? It wasn't given an instruction. It wasn't told the scope. It wasn't told what it could bar, not bar. How in the world on that record do we reverse on the release issue?
Sure. Well, I would like to address first the consent by implication here. Because I hear you, Your Honor, there was not a jury instruction on the release. But the release language bars this claim as a matter of law. This was a question that was in the province of the trial court. The trial court in the motion—
I know, but that's a good argument, and I want you to finish it, but here's my concern. You never put the release issue to the judge at summary judgment, right?
I think it was mentioned at summary judgment, but it wasn't the
mentioned, but it was not a ground for granting summary judgment.
Fair enough.
So there's no ruling from the court, the district court, on the release issue.
I disagree with that. At the motion for directed verdict at the close of the plaintiff's case in chief, there was a motion that explicitly requested that the court—
No, okay. We're moving to the trial in a second. I want to go in phases.
Oh, no worries.
So there's no ruling at summary judgment from the district court on the release issue.
I think that that's fair.
Right. So what you're left with is whether or not this was effectively tried and brought to someone's attention at trial, right?
Correct.
Okay, go ahead.
And again, what this court held in the Peterson versus Kloss case is that where even slight evidence was brought to bear in the case, it was sufficient to bring an unpled affirmative defense within the trial. What we have here is multiple times in the case, not only in the opening statements, not only in the closing statements, but actually in the testimony. Mr. Rushen's counsel read the release language into the record at the trial. The jury heard the language. They heard Mr. Moss testify that he's not bound to the release because Mr. Rushen didn't live up to his end of the agreement. And again, I want to address the leave to amend, because we do argue in our brief that that was error to deny leave to amend. There wasn't a requirement for Mr. Rushen.
I know, but that only gets you to start all over again.
It does.
It doesn't get you a judgment on the merits.
We understand that, Your Honor, but in this case, it is a proper basis to reverse.
It also, just in fairness, while we're talking about it, I guess it's going to require you to overcome an abuse of discretion standard of review, right?
It is. It is, Judge Newsom. You are correct. And we think that there was abuse of discretion here. The magistrate judge, in denying leave to amend, did abuse her discretion, and here's why. The motion for leave to amend was filed a month after the case management order, maybe a month and 2 to 3 weeks. There was no deadline for leave to amend. This was new counsel that came into the case, and within that time period, within a two-month time period, did Rule 26 disclosures, a case management order, and then promptly moved for leave to amend. In the motion for leave to amend, the defendants here explicitly laid out bases that are good cause to amend. There had been little to no discovery at all in the case, therefore there would be no prejudice to the plaintiffs. He was new counsel in the case, and also this is a dispositive defense. If I can turn briefly to the DuPont case, because the DuPont case is what establishes, and we think that we do get over this hurdle over whether or not this was tried by consent or whether or not the magistrate judge abused her discretion. There's no case that I have seen where there's been a denial of leave to amend about a year before trial, a month after the case management order, that has been upheld as not an abuse of discretion standard. But here, the DuPont case, because this case is governed by Delaware law as far as release goes. Under Delaware law and DuPont, the court said, when you have a general release, the contours of that release is governed by the recitals and the subject matter of the agreement. There's no dispute in this case that the subject matter of the release agreement was the Chemotech Commission. And so what separates our case from the DuPont case, where the Delaware Supreme Court said a specific release was needed, is this. In the DuPont case, what was released by the plaintiffs in that case were essentially apples. It was claims related to the fungicide that DuPont developed that the plaintiffs used in nurseries, whereas the subsequent action related to oranges. In effect, it was about litigation tactics of DuPont's attorneys in litigation years later about withholding discovery. And so that's why when you had an agreement that settled claims, you needed a specific release to get the oranges out the case, because they already got rid of the apples to the release. In our case, we're only dealing with apples. The release agreement related to the Chemotech transaction, the alleged fraud is that Mr. Rushen defrauded Mr. Moss and Persine, the plaintiffs, from the Chemotech Commission.
So I'm trying to follow along, but I just want to make sure. Would the other side not say we're still in apples and oranges land because the apples are the Chemotech deal and the oranges are the release letter? And they say the fraud runs to the release letter, not to the Chemotech deal sort of in the abstract.
Well, that distinction is almost a distinction without a difference. The release letter is about the Chemotech Commission. That's what it's about. It's in essence creating a new regime that the parties agreed to live under. That's the point of a general release. It's to get peace. And the parties said, okay, I know you're entitled to 2.5% here. We're going to release for forever and a day those claims, and this is the regime that we're going to live under. And if there was a breach of that agreement, the proper claim was a breach of contract, not a fraud action. And the rule in Florida is pretty clear. You cannot have a fraud based on unfulfilled promises. And the fact of the matter is the circumstantial evidence that was brought forth below was inconsequential and insubstantial as a matter of law to convert this run-of-the-mill breach of contract case into one for fraud.
What about the response, assuming we can get to the releases, what about the response that this is really fraud in the inducement type claim, that there was allegedly no intent on the part of your clients to perform, and that the promises for further action down the road were just lies to get the other side to do what they did and to sign the releases, and that Florida recognizes that sort of fraud in the inducement type claim and doesn't just limit you to a contract remedy in that scenario?
We fully recognize, Judge Jordan, that Florida law does create that very narrow exception. What we're arguing is the circumstantial evidence here does not meet that exception, because the evidence that was presented below was that not my client, Mr. Rushen, but that certain individuals at American Private Equity didn't return a couple of emails, that Mr. Rushen breached a prior agreement, therefore we should believe that he has a propensity to keep on breaching agreements in the future. They should believe that Mr. Rushen did not have credibility, so that in and of itself should be enough to find him liable for fraud. This evidence is just simply insufficient as a matter of law. If it was pled as a basis for fraud in a pleading, I am doubtful that it would be accepted. I do want to close on this.
Don't you also have the, let me see if I remember my facts correctly. Don't you also have evidence that Mr. Rushen was immediately trying to renege on the initial promise of percentage on the deal? And isn't that evidence from which a jury could think that this is all just a scam, and every time he promises he's going to do something, he's not doing it. He just wants someone to latch on and agree with him, and then he'll go ahead and do whatever he needs to do to get on top.
Your Honor correctly states the facts, but that's not the proper conclusion that would be drawn through competent evidence. It's fully fair for the jury to hear about Mr. Rushen renegotiating the deal, but the reality is that an offer of 45% is not an agreement for 45%. That's all it was. It was an offer, and in the negotiations, that changed. It's too much of a leap to say that's a breach of an agreement. I see my time is running out. May I have time to answer your question and conclude? Sure. So Mr. Rushen simply renegotiating is not evidence that he has a propensity to breach every agreement that he gets in from here on out.
Renegotiating is a kind term. at least given the jury verdict that we're dealing with.
But given Florida law, Your Honor, it's the only term that should be used. Because
one of them is you agreed to a percentage commission, and then all of a sudden when you saw that the total amount was going to go down, you said, I'm not giving you that amount. I know we agreed to it, but I'm getting less, you're getting less. End of story. And that's not renegotiation.
Well, Your Honor, again, when I'm talking about renegotiation, I'm referring to the 45% to the 40%. That was renegotiation. I agree with you that there was an agreement for the 2.5% and that was not paid, that the parties entered a new agreement before the 2.5% would be paid. I'm not denying those facts. I'm simply saying that the offer that was initially made in November 2015 to pay 45%, that wasn't an agreement. That wasn't a breach of a promise. And if we convert negotiations between businessmen who are well-versed in this area as a basis for fraud, we're going to convert every contract case into a lurking case for fraud. So for those reasons, we ask that the court reverse the judgments below.
All right, thank you very much, Mr. Robinson. You've saved your 2 minutes for rebuttal. Mr. Onius. Is it Onius or Onias?
Onias.
Onias.
Please the court.
Morning.
Good morning, Your Honors. This case is about a corporate defendant who I represent, American Private Equity, their right to defend themselves against all accusations of breach of contract and fraud with merit. The issues that we brought up in the appeal, first issue is I want to go back and touch the release letter, which we find that the release letter itself, the motion to amend the pleading initially brought by counsel, the denial of that put APE in a detrimental position because it did not afford APE the ability to show to the court that there was language in the release letter that had released them. It did not allow APE to provide the jury, as the principal trier of facts, the ability to make this determination whether or not the language is applicable. And we find that the magistrate's judge ruling on that stating that basically the time had passed because the scheduling order had been already put in place on June 6th was mechanical. It was not one of which was taken with great consideration as of the circumstances, because
was there an objection to
Mr. No, there wasn't.
Robinson says that there was a ruling by the magistrate judge denying leave to amend. Was there an objection to the district judge?
There was no objection to the district judge, Your Honor, but it seems as though that the rationale from the magistrate was that it was untimely. Now, for the sake of moving cases along on the docket quickly, we understand that, but when the rights of a defendant, a corporate defendant, are at stake here, I think it has to be a little more. Now, good cause, it's stated in her order that good cause was not brought up. The magic words weren't said, but the counsel in the lower court did specifically state that he was new to the case. He only had a month to review this case, and this is a complex transaction with different areas of law that are applied to this. You have Delaware law that applies to the release letter, and then you have Florida law applying to the contractual claims. So it's not a case where you can just jump on and you have a week to make a determination that you know what to do. So we find that greatly prejudiced APE to be able to amend and state that claim of a defense.
Had I been the district judge, I think I probably would have granted leave to amend, given that trial was a year away and discovery had barely started. But as Judge Newsom says, you're not getting de novo review on that issue. So, but I think we understand your position.
So, Your Honor, with that said, in closing, I believe specifically that the court committed reversible error on that topic.
Okay, Mr. Anais, thank you very much.
Good morning. Thank you, Your Honors, for this opportunity. May it please the court. Juan Martinez on behalf of the plaintiff's appellees. To me, it's pretty clear the release was not pled. The new counsel, just so that you're aware, filed his unopposed stipulation for substitution more than 2 months prior to filing the motion for leave to amend. They had the release letter all the time. It was an exhibit to the complaint. Neither the first counsel nor the second counsel, up until July 25th, sought to assert the affirmative defense. Judge Sneed gave them the opportunity to come back and show good cause, and she outlined in her order in detail that good cause requires diligent effort, and they were allowed to do that to present it. They did not. They never raised it again. At no point during the trial did they seek to amend the pleadings. They take the position here that it was tried by consent. I disagree with that. All they can point to in terms of the evidence was a question posed to my client by defense counsel regarding the language of the release. That language was in the record. The whole release letter was in the record. That formed the basis of our breach of contract count. And I cite the case law from this circuit that introduction of evidence arguably relevant to pleaded issues cannot serve to put a party on notice that new issues are entering the case.
Well, Mr. Robinson says in part that the defendants brought the issue of the releases on their motion for judgment as a matter of law at the close of the evidence. What's your response to that?
If you read that carefully, if you read his argument, you will see that his argument was actually based on the sufficiency of evidence. At no point in the record that I recall, and I've read it carefully, at no point in the record does Mr. Hardin, defense counsel, ask the judge to enter judgment as a matter of law based on the language of the release. His argument focused squarely on whether there was sufficient evidence to support a finding of fraud. So I disagree with that contention. But even if it was tried, and Your Honor made a good point, it was never submitted to the jury. There was no jury instructions on it. It was not on the verdict form. And that's because it wasn't tried by consent. But even if you consider the release, I believe that the DuPont case is squarely on point, and I agree with Judge Newsom. It is apples and oranges. We don't contend, and we've never contended, that the fraud related to the initial retention of Mr. Moss. We contend that the fraud related to the release letter. And applying DuPont, it's clear, at least in my mind, that the release cannot release a claim for fraud relating to fraud to enter into the release.
That has to be, this is my last question. This has to be fraud in the inducement then, right?
Yes.
That's my question too.
Yes. It was clearly fraud in the inducement. Induced Mr. Moss to enter into that release letter.
So when Delaware law says that releases have to specifically identify fraud, if they're going to release fraud, is what they really mean, they have to specifically identify fraud in the inducement?
I believe.
If it's fraud as to the entry of the thing that is purportedly releasing the fraud, so you don't get into this infinite loop, it has to specifically identify the fraud in the inducement. That's what they really mean. Not sort of organic fraud in the transaction more generally.
I believe that that's exactly the case. And that was our contention all along, that Mr. Rushen's actions induced Mr. Moss to enter into that release letter. Also note that the release letter, even if it were to apply, it says that it releases anything that happened before the date of the release letter. So even from a timing perspective, it wouldn't apply.
Well, but fraud in the inducement necessarily occurs before the execution of the release, does it not?
Well, I could.
I mean, if I sign a release letter with you at, 9:58, and I claim that you defrauded me, all that defrauding is going to occur before 9:58, right?
Well,
unless you defrauded me as I was inking the thing.
I see your point, but I think that the fraud continues through. The fraud continues through the date of the execution of the release.
But that still would have. I mean, I take your point, and I'm generally persuaded by it. But had the release occurred, had the release been pled, litigated, and all that, there's a chance that a chunk of it might have been knocked out. A chunk of your evidence might have been knocked out on fraud in the inducement, if the release applied.
If the release applied. And I don't think it applies based on DuPont. Moving on to the sufficiency of the evidence. It's not only that Mr. Rushen reneged. It's the whole totality of the circumstances. Mr. Moss sends him an email at the beginning of November saying, Mr. Rushen, are you gonna honor that 2.5% commission? Mr. Rushen responds, says, yes, you're getting 2.5. 5 hours later, he sends a second email. No, now you're only going to get 40% of what we receive. A month later, there's the meeting in Brazil, and I think that that's a critical element that really wasn't discussed by appellant's counsel. Mr. Moss lives in Brazil. Mr. Rushen goes to Brazil, and they had agreed to meet. And Mr. Rushen then avoids Mr. Moss. Finally, they do meet. And they have the meeting where, and it's even set forth in their brief, where Mr. Rushen tells Mr. Moss, I'm the big guy and you're the little guy, and this is what we're gonna do, and you really have no other choice. But then offers him the 3-year, $50,000 per year agreement in order to convince Mr. Moss to sign. When I asked Mr. Rushen in deposition, and this testimony was read to the jury, why did you refuse or why did you hesitate to meet Mr. Moss in Brazil? And Mr. Rushen's response was, well, he was harassing me, he was acting crazy, and I feared for my safety. Well, if he feared for his safety, and if Mr. Moss was acting crazy and harassing him, why would he agree to partner for 3 more years going forward? And that's evidence that the jury heard, and the jury can draw its inferences from that, from everything together. I think I have responded to the points made by them here in oral argument. Unless there's any questions, I will rest on my brief.
There's one more contention, and that is that whatever evidence might have supported the damages verdict on the fraud claim, you did not sustain your burden to like you to at least briefly address that.
Well, I believe the same evidence. The jury specifically found.
Except that you've got a slightly different burden of proof, right?
Right, and they were instructed on it, the clear and convincing evidence.
But all I'm saying is, theoretically at least, abstractly at least, your ability to prevail on a fraud verdict under one standard doesn't necessarily answer the question of getting punitives under a slightly different standard. So I'd like you to at least touch on it.
Well, I believe that the same evidence that established a preponderance of the evidence standard or satisfied that standard also satisfies a clear and convincing standard. What did the jury find? The jury found that Mr. Rushen defrauded Mr. Moss, and torts based on fraud are one of the is what gives rise to punitive damages. The jury also found that the defendants acted with wanton disregard of Mr. Moss's rights. The evidence supports that. The reneging on the deal, the convincing Mr. Moss to enter into the agreement to forego $460,000+ with a promise of $150,000 with no intention to actually honor that. That is wanton disregard of Mr. Moss's rights. That's what the jury found, and there was evidence to support that, both on the preponderance standard and the clear and convincing standard.
All right, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Very briefly, Your Honors.
He says that if you look at the argument, and I haven't gone back to look at it, so I don't know who's right or who's wrong, or both of you are partially right and partially wrong, but he says that in the motion for judgment as a matter of law, what lawyers still call directed verdict, that there was no request to the district court to knock out the fraud claims based on the releases.
Incorrect. So if we look at Appendix 4, which is volume 3 of the transcript, page 118, lines 8 of that page through page 119, line 23. Mr. Rushen's counsel caps, after he reads the release into the record at the motion directed verdict, he says this to the trial judge. So I believe that, referring to the release, as well as the unambiguous language that's contained in the release, is sufficient for a judgment as a matter of law to be entered. And I also made a mistake with you earlier, Judge Jordan. We did move for summary judgment on the release. It's on page 18 of our motion for summary judgment. So that was brought before the trial judge.
What did the district judge do on that?
He denied it.
No. With the release claim that you asserted on summary judgment, denied it on the merits or said you haven't properly pled it or what?
No, he didn't say we properly pled it. He said that there's a lot of factual questions that we have to resolve it at trial. But that the order is also in the record as well. But if I can briefly, I know I have like 30 seconds, I'd like to address some of the other items that my friend here on the other side raised. Regarding the release only applying to past conduct, that's not true, I'm gonna explain why, but to address Judge Newsom's point, fraud and inducement may be barred by general releases. That's what the Seven Investments Court held in the Delaware Chancery Court. There's no distinction between fraud versus fraud and inducement as far as the general release goes. The reason why a specific release was needed in the DuPont case is because the alleged fraud was not within the contemplation of the parties' agreement. It related to something else that was separate from what was being litigated. Here, what was in everyone's mind was the Chemotech transaction. And in those releases, the fourth release itself says it's going to bar claims like as, you know, prior to the date of the agreement. The fifth release doesn't say that. The first release doesn't say that. And also, if you look at the trial transcript, and I want to make sure that I give this to your honors, the testimony of Mr. Moss, as well as the testimony of Mr. Rushen, is that the agreement to forego the Chemotech commission occurred on December 11th, weeks before the release letter was signed. So even if we buy their argument about the fourth release not applying prospectively or retroactively, it doesn't matter, because the date that this alleged fraud came into fruition, it was on December 11th when Mr. Moss testifies that he agreed to forego his commission. So for those reasons, and for the fact that this evidence is certainly not clear and convincing evidence of fraud, this court should reverse the judgment against Mr. Rushen below for fraud and punitive damages. Thank you.
All right, thank you very much, Mr. Robinson, Mr. Onias, Mr. Martinez. We'll take a look. Bye. Have a good afternoon. Bye-bye. Take your time in getting set up. We're not rushing you. This is case number